It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a provocative look at the history of alcohol in America as seen through the eyes of British journalist Andrew Barr. We don't treat alcohol the way Europeans do. Our taboos and excesses are strictly American. Barr claims prohibition was really the establishment's backlash to the flood of immigrants in the early 1900s. And he links our drinking habits to women's rights and even racism. Shane and Michael Stern have found an old stagecoach stop in California artichoke country. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has wines to grill by. Cheese maven Steve Jenkins takes us to the heart of France. And it's open lines for your calls. All this and more coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, macaroni and cheese beyond the blue box. Homemade mac and cheese is easy, economical, and you can do it ahead. We're going to look at some old-time recipes that transform this down-home basic into an elegant dish, and then we're going to talk about good old grandma-style mac and cheese. Macaroni and cheese can be as simple as tossing fresh-cooked elbow macaroni with a combination of shredded cheeses and maybe a little milk or cream. Old-time recipes are usually made with a bechamel sauce, combined with cheese and noodles, then baked with a breadcrumb topping. Now, until about 50 years ago, the cheese used to be a good yellow cheddar, sometimes simply called store cheese because every general store had it. So here's one tip right off the bat. Try really good-tasting cheddar when you make mac and cheese. But let's start with a little history. In Italy, in the 13 and 1400s, people who cooked for the aristocrats of the time were tossing pasta with cheeses, spices, and other exotica. Italy dictated a lot of what was considered hot and chic back then all over Europe, so it's not surprising to discover that England had a version of macaroni and cheese that could really be great, and it was probably the great-great-granddaddy of ours. Try this idea. I think you're going to like it, and it's a good history lesson for the family. Just remember that back at that time, during the Renaissance, pasta was eaten by the wealthy, not by the peasants. Okay, this is mac and cheese as Shakespeare might have eaten it. Use three cheeses, a nutty-tasting one like Gruyere, a creamy one like Esploratore or even cream cheese, and Parmigiano Reggiano. It did exist in England back then. It was an Italian import and pretty expensive. Blend the cheeses with the cooked pasta and a little cream. Put everything in a casserole and top it with toasted almonds, black pepper, and a sprinkling of more Parmigiano. And now here's the surprise. Add sugar and cinnamon. Bake it until bubbly. Now this seasoning with grated cheese, sugar, pepper, and cinnamon may seem strange to us, but it was really popular in medieval times. Back then, sugar and spices were status symbols, and they flavored foods from the beginning of a meal straight through to the end in dessert. Now for some down-home Americana. A real old-time macaroni and cheese from earlier in this century. Make the bechamel sauce. Most basic cookbooks are going to have a recipe. But the secret trick to make this unforgettable is add to the bechamel sauce as it simmers some minced onion, a pinch of ground cloves, a bay leaf or two, and some sweet paprika. Once the sauce is cooked, strain it, and then stir in some good sharp cheddar. Toss it with that cooked macaroni, butter a deep casserole, spread a layer of the noodles, a layer of more shredded cheese, the rest of the noodles, and more shredded cheese, and then toast some fresh breadcrumbs in butter in a skillet, and top the casserole with them. Bake and enjoy. Now, one other thing you can do, and this is real grandma food. Grandma, along with that cheese, would layer in leftover cooked vegetables. For instance, steamed carrots, or maybe sautéed green beans, or maybe some sweet fresh peas from the garden. Now you've got a main dish. The other day I improvised an even faster mac and cheese with more zip and a little less fat. Now remember, this is an idea, so play with it and make it your own. In a processor or blender, mix together an egg, some skim milk, garlic, a generous amount of onion, lots of that sharp cheddar, some Neuchâtel cream cheese, Tabasco, seasonings like salt, pepper, and maybe paprika. Toss with a quarter pound of cooked elbow noodles, put it in that deep baking dish, and then mix crumbled saltines with a little melted butter. Put them on top of the casserole and bake everything about 30 or 35 minutes. So, we've got macaroni and cheese as Shakespeare might have eaten it, macaroni and cheese like Grandma used to think she made, and macaroni and cheese with a little extra zing for those days when you need a pick-me-up. So, pick up some good cheddar, get those elbow noodles cooking, and give some real homemade mac and cheese a try. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about food, enjoying it, buying it, cooking it, and about eating out, entertaining, health, and travel. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials. 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality, heavyweight cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bakley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we've got a controversial look at the history of drinking in America. British writer Andrew Barr first did a book on the history of alcohol in Great Britain, and now he has published Drink, A Social History of America. Andrew Barr examines who we are through our attitudes toward drinking, and with that as a beginning, he brings a unique point of view to the history of women's rights, prohibition, the Puritans, and even racism. I think after hearing him, you may find that you're going to look at that bottle of beer or glass of wine a little differently. Well, we leap from social history to what in heaven's name are you going to serve tonight with the grilled burgers? Wine entrepreneur Joshua Wesson has wines to grill by. If you're considering a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou, along with some cheese, Steve Jenkins, a guy who knows much more about this subject than anyone ought to, is introducing us to the cheeses of an unknown area of France, the Auvergne. Legendary cooking teacher Marion Cunningham is back with a lesson for beginners, and after all of these revelations, we're turning the second half of the show over to you. It's open lines for your calls. The number's 1-800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They roam the country looking for good food, and they write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, what have you two been up to?
Lynn, we've been browsing around California artichoke country. And in doing so, we went to one of the most wonderful old, and I mean 100-year-old restaurants you could ever find in Pescadero, California.
Now, is that up north? Because that's artichoke country up north, isn't it?
It is up north. It's not far from San Francisco. The restaurant is called Duarte's. And 100 years ago, it was a stagecoach stop, and it hasn't changed a whole lot since then. I mean, there is a street with car parking outside, but the restaurant itself has been gradually and, haphazardly kind of built up over the years, so it still has the wonderful charm of an old stage stop.
I'll tell you how good the food is, Lynn. I really was ready to never speak to my husband again because he did that man thing of getting the needle on the gas tank so close to E that, you know, we were driving on vapors, and this is a fairly...
I was playing chicken.
Yeah, he was playing chicken, and this just is my worst panic that we're going to run out of gas in the middle of nowhere. So we coasted into Duarte's on our... On fumes and vapors, and I was really ready to call the divorce lawyer from the restaurant. And we sat down to a meal that was so incredibly delicious that we were practically honeymooners by the time we left again.
Okay, I've got to hear about the meal. I'll bite. Tell me about what you ate.
If you're going to bite for breakfast, the thing to have is an artichoke omelet, which is just wonderful. I mean, they do everything with artichokes. They make artichoke soup. They stuff artichokes with a fennel sausage that they make there. They have dinner. The cream of artichoke soup comes with dinner. But beyond artichoke, I mean, I don't want to make this seem like some sort of a theme restaurant, because the fact is artichokes are native to the area, so they serve a lot of them, but there's a whole lot more to eat at Duarte's. In fact, I remember one Friday night, I don't know if they do this every Friday, but we had, I would say, the best chowpino I've ever eaten.
Now, you have to explain what chowpino is.
It's a slumgullion stew, as it were, a kind of seafood stew that that tourists eat down over on the docks in San Francisco.
But they don't eat it this good.
They don't eat it this good. I mean, this has Dungeness crab, mussels, prawns, clams, with good sourdough bread to dunk in the juice. It's heaven.
And and for dessert, they have a very unusual local specialty in that part of California, which is a lolliberry pie.
Olalleberry.
I think I'm saying it right. It's O-L-A-L-L-I-E.
And it sounds like it comes on a stick.
No, it comes on a plate, and it's wedge-shaped, and it's just a delicious, wonderful berry pie with vanilla ice cream smushing all over the top.
But the other thing you have to know about Duarte's is that the food is great, but the place itself, I mean, the minute we walked into this many years ago, this has been a favorite of ours for years, is every table is mismatched. They have different, you know, different plates for different people. Some chairs are soft, some chairs are hard. They're kind of arranged in a mixed up sort of way. It's like going to a
truck stop, but it's a truck stop that serves 4-star food. I mean, great sand dabs, Rexole. I mean, the kind of things you would eat at the fanciest grill in San Francisco. You can eat Stern style, just, you know, in this roadhouse in the middle of nowhere.
Is there some sort of funny artichoke stuff they do? Because when you get into places like that, sometimes it's something like, you know, candy-coated artichokes.
No, they don't do any of that dopey, you know, it's not like artichoke.
I didn't want to say that. I didn't want to say dumb stuff.
I know what you mean. I mean, there are places all over California, whether it's dates or artichokes or whatever, that, you know, you wind up with oh, my gosh, you know,
artichoke bubble bath.
Date foot cream with estrogen in it or something. I mean, it's, you know, this is not a goofy place, but it certainly does. I mean, Alice Waters would be impressed with this. It takes of its local produce and uses it beautifully.
So no artichoke-scented candles are for sale in the gift shop.
We hope not. There is no gift shop, so.
Stench that would be, wouldn't that, it?
Awful.
Unless they have hollandaise candles on the side.
Hey, you two, thanks.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the
Hollandaise candles notwithstanding, Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. They join us every single week, and every single week you can find their restaurant discoveries on our website at splendidtable.org. And while visiting, be sure to drop by the Splendid Table store. You can get autographed copies of our regular contributors' books, and, geez, right now, check out the toffee. Need I say more? Well, yeah. All the proceeds from the store go to support the show. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert with an entrepreneurial streak. He started a chain of shops called Best Sellers, where all the wines are priced under $10. Joshua's frugal and creative approach to wine drinking makes him one of our favorite contributors. Hi, Josh.
How are you?
I'm fine. Hey, I'd like to talk about grilling.
Ooh, my favorite subject this time of year, because I just wheeled my Weber out onto my tiny Romeo and Juliet balcony, and I cleaned off the grill, and I am ready to grill a whole heap of foods this weekend.
But wine with grilled foods, that's a little bit of a challenge.
Well, most people don't think of putting wine with the Weber. When they fire up that kettle and they throw some burgers or hot dogs or chicken on there, everybody's sort of synaptically leading to beer.
But, that's right, yeah. Beer or, you know, Long Island iced tea or something
beer,
like that.
Beer, Mr. Pibb, Diet Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, yeah.
But I happen to love wine with all different things that come off the grill. And I love to mess with a wide range of wines, but I always come back to two or three different kinds that seem to work with just about everything. They're the great equalizers at the picnic table when you're pulling burgers and dogs off the grill.
What are they?
Well, we always think about hot dogs and burgers and chicken and brats, and we tend to forget all the condiments that we slather on top of these foods. And it's the condiments that drive the wine selections, and a lot of the condiments that people like to put on grilled food these days have an element of pungence and sweetness to them. So one of the first wines that I stick in my little hamper is a Gewürztraminer from California. I avoid the Gewürztraminers that come from Alsace because they're dry and they can be bitter, mm-hmm. and they can also be very alcoholic. Those are all bad things with sweet condiments. But California Gewürztraminer is light and a little bit sweet, and it's unbelievably good with relish on top of hot dogs or ketchup on top of burgers or that sweet tangy sauce that people love to put on chicken.
So you're talking about a white wine with hamburgers.
Yes, I know. It's considered sacrosanct. People love to have red wine with meat. That's what everyone follows. It's sacrilege to have white wine with meat, but it's great to do it when the meat doesn't matter if you put some ketchup or some sweet sauce on it. It really doesn't. Then you're just matching wine to the sauce. And that's why I love sweet wines like California Gewürztraminers, and even Chenin Blancs are fine. One of my favorites is a Fetzer. It's inexpensive. It's available everywhere. You go for the 1998, the youngest wine around, and it washes all of that sweet stuff right off the palate.
Well, that sounds great. Well, any other choices, though? Can I drink red wine with any of this stuff? Are there red wines?
Well, a lot of people don't like to put sweet things on top of their burgers or chicken. Sometimes they'll just have it straight off the grill, or they may put sauerkraut on top of a hot dog, a little bit of mustard. Mm-hmm. Then you don't want the sweetness. You want something that's going to cut through the sauerkraut, which is tangy, and cut through the mustard, which is pungent. And beer is great, but there's a Vinous Stunt Double for beer, which is sparkling wine. And one of my favorites is another California wine, a Mumm Cuvée Napa. It's a non-vintage, not expensive, not too complex, but it is unbelievably good with all of those kind of savory, sharp flavors that come out of condiments that you put on things like hot dogs.
So you're saying I'm going to serve a sparkling wine, I could even lie in my teeth and tell my friends it's champagne, with my grilled foods.
Yeah, and it tastes even better when you stick it in a little, you know, jam jar. All of these things taste best when they don't come in stem glasses. And there's a third wine that I always bring to barbecue, and what I bring to grilled picnics.
Right.
And that would be a light to medium-bodied red wine. And one of my favorites these past few weeks has been the Hogue Cabernet Merlot, Hogue Cellars Cabernet Merlot.
Uh-huh.
It's medium-bodied. It's got a lot of delicious cherry berry fruit. Doesn't have a lot of tannin to make your mouth pucker up. It's $7-$8 a bottle, and it's just unbelievably delicious with chicken without a sweet sauce, or grilled steak, or burgers without any sweet condiments. Just it rounds out the circle of the wine selection. So three wines, that's all you need on your wine list the next time you fire up your Weber and you start grilling different foods.
Joshua, thank you.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops and visits the Splendid Table regularly. You can get his picks for wines to grill by on our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Coming up, Drink, A Social History of America, Stellar Cheeses from a Little Visited Area of France, and your calls. Get on the line at 1-800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family. Just like you do here, it's a Splendid Table each week. Find them online at Target.com. Consider for a moment how we Americans treat alcohol. Our pendulum swings to such extremes. We've had prohibition and then martini bars, Alcoholics Anonymous and wine tastings. We lump together the regulating of alcohol with weapons, as though the two are equally threatening. Yet many toast the arrival of a new baby with champagne. America's relationship with alcohol is an intriguing study. Today we're going to look at the history of alcohol in our country through the eyes of an Englishman. Journalist Andrew Barr has written a social history of wine in Great Britain. His latest book is Drink, A Social History of America. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lynn.
Andrew, in the book Drink, you look at the history of alcohol in the United States. Can you walk us through that? Can you tell us what are the major elements that have formed our attitudes toward drink in this country?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's not entirely about alcohol. It's about drink in general, anything we consume, because I think people tend to look at alcohol on its own.
Uh-huh.
In fact, in many cases, the choice to drink water or tea or something else is linked in there. And those two are particular American tastes. I mean, if you go back to when the first European settlers came to America in the 17th century, and they came from countries, particularly in the case of England, that is really quite damp and mild all the year round.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really taken aback in the north to come to a climate that was hot in summer and very cold in winter, and in the south to come to a place that was pretty warm the year round and where there was a lot of problem with diseases that they just didn't know about. So they couldn't really take their own drink's taste and keep them, and what they tended to drink was quite mild, full-bodied, traditional English beer, and it just wasn't suitable for the climate. So one thing they did was try and develop means of cooling down the drinks by using ice.
Now, was that to preserve the drinks?
No, it was just to make it taste fresher.
Uh-huh.
Now, the problem was, where do you get ice if you don't have a refrigerator, and they didn't exist? What happened was an ice trade built up, particularly the following century, and harvesting ice from the north and the midwest in the winter and storing it in ice houses for use during the summer. So you got the development of particular American tastes for very cold, very ice drinks, which simply hadn't been the case in Europe. It still seems bizarre, even to me. I mean, I come over here to the States quite often. I still find it very odd when I ask for a glass of water to be given a glass of ice with a little bit of water in it. And that's a peculiar American taste. It's a response of essentially English immigrants to a strange climate. When the first colonists came down to Georgia in the 1730s, and a lot of them started drinking rum immediately, thinking it was good for them in hot weather, they had this notion that if you sweated in hot weather, your stomach needed to be warmed up afterwards by drinking spirits. So a lot of them drank rum, and there were a number who died the first summer, and that was the first prohibition ever introduced, was in the new colony of Georgia to try and stop too many people making themselves ill and dying from drinking rum in hot weather.
So that was the beginning of prohibition in the United States.
Didn't last for very long. It didn't work. And the irony about all the attempts at prohibition that have failed is this first experiment in the 1730s and early 1740s, this failed for exactly the same reasons as later prohibition failed. Basically, people who wanted to get hold of alcohol could get hold of it quite easily. They just smuggled it across the river from South Carolina.
Uh-huh. Well, when those first settlers came here, they were I'm thinking of the Northeast, the Puritans settled in Massachusetts. Now, the Puritans were beer drinkers and spirit drinkers?
Puritans drank a lot of cider and a lot of beer and a certain amount of rum. There were complaints by some Puritan preachers that some people were drinking too much rum, but this idea that the Puritans were puritanical about drink just isn't true. They had absolutely no problem about people drinking as long as they drank in reasonable quantities and didn't get too drunk. This whole idea of Puritan attitudes really is 19th century Protestant evangelical revivalist attitudes. the idea is that you shouldn't drink, that women in particular should not drink, because they were the salvation of the species. They were the people who contributed a feeling of spirituality. And the idea also that wine should not be served in religious services, which is contrary to what the Bible says.
Well, now this brings us to the prohibition of this century in the 1920s. Now, that movement lasted for a very long time, and it affected the entire country. What specifically was going on at that time that we had this sort of sweeping away of alcohol, or at least an attempt at it?
Yeah, there were lots of different elements that led to prohibition. And one of the ways I've tried to write my book is by looking at different themes in American history and different topics in American history. And, for example, the relationship between women and drinking, and how far it used to be thought historically that women shouldn't drink, and how far female movements, and particularly proto-feminist movements, led to prohibition as a means of stopping men from drinking, because a lot of women had already renounced drink. Another major theme leading up to prohibition was a tension between what was then the established American Protestant way of living, which had, in essence, taken over evangelical principles, and people were expected to work hard and they were expected not to drink. And the attitudes of a whole new range of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, millions of them from Italy and Greece and Russia, who were very used to drinking, not just in their religious services, but drinking wine with meals, with leisurely meals. And it was thought these new immigrants behaved in a way that was un-American and was inappropriate for a country founded on hard work. It was just thought of as lazy. And their wine drinking habits were attacked partly because this was regarded as symptomatic of old-fashioned, old-country, European ways that needed to be got rid of in the New World.
Huh.
There's a big anti-immigrant, even racist element to the Prohibition movement. The same was true. They had Prohibition 100 years earlier, and that was essentially an anti-Irish, anti-German immigrant movement, much the same idea. This racist element also explains, I think, why the Prohibition movement died out in the end, because the Prohibitionists were great supporters of, or at least some of them were great supporters of, Nazi Germany in the period leading up to the Second World War, because they felt that some of Hitler's policies, which were anti-drink, which were eugenicist, which were about producing a healthier, purer race,
uh-huh.
were a great idea. And of course, by the time war broke out, those attitudes became discredited, and so prohibition became discredited with it.
Now, Andrew, you mentioned the women's movement tied into prohibition. What do you mean?
Yeah, there's this idea, which is quite important, that there was a strong connection between feminism and prohibition as an attempt by women to stop their menfolk from frittering away their time and money by drinking in saloons. And this was particularly true when the frontier was opened up in the early 19th century, and families went out to the West on their own in isolated communities, and the men worked hard all day. The women were left at home on their own, miles from any support, with the children. If the men then, after working, went to the few saloons that were available and drank, they were wasting their money and they weren't protecting their women and children. So there was a significant growth of the feminist movement as an attempt to stop men from drinking too much. And to a certain extent, one of the reasons why many women espoused feminism as a cause in the second half of the 19th century was in order to have the vote, in order to have prohibition imposed. Because women didn't have the vote, and it's no coincidence that female suffrage and prohibition were introduced nationally in the same year, 1920. It's equally no coincidence that from that point onwards, women in general lost interest in the temperance cause. Because of course, once women felt that they had the same sort of rights as men, then there were a lot of people who felt the need to do everything that men did, and that included drinking.
Did it work in the other way? In so many words, weren't there movements that limited women consuming alcohol?
Yes. At the same time, there is a long tradition, and this goes back certainly to Roman times, early Roman times, of telling women they shouldn't drink because it was felt there might be a risk to the children they bore. These ideas have come and gone in history. And recently, in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of discussion about fetal alcohol syndrome. No one had a name for it, but there was a notion that if women drank too much, there might be a risk of damage to male children. It was male children who were the real concern. And really, the issue was, this was particularly marked in England in the 18th century when there was a big problem with gin drinking by women, but also in America in the 19th century. There was the notion that women shouldn't drink because there was a need to produce lots of male children to go and work hard in the fields to expand the country, and in the case of England, to go and fight overseas and expand the empire.
Now, how are our American attitudes toward alcohol different to those in Britain and in Europe?
They are more different from those on the continent of Europe to those in Britain, I think. In Europe, it really depends whether you're talking about Northern Europe, which has a beer and spirits culture, which has influenced a lot of American drinking habits, and the Southern Europe, which attempted to introduce wine drinking culture to America at the turn of the century, but failed. And it's only last few years, really, that a lot of people have taken to drinking wine again, and in many cases, taken to drinking it because they think it's good for them, rather than because it's part of a lifestyle they want to lead. Whereas in Southern Europe, it's still pretty common to have a 2 or 3 hour break for lunch during the working week, go to a restaurant, drink some wine, and nobody thinks any worse of you for it.
Andrew, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Barr is author of Drink, A Social History of America. Steve Jenkins, our cheese maven, the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer and Cheesemonger Extraordinaire in New York City, joins us from time to time to talk about, well, whatever is on his mind. Steve, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you.
So, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, you guys always say, what do you want to talk about? And I want to talk about details, because my whole career is this little village and this particular cheesemaker, and am I going to be able to smuggle this in, and can I get this past customs? And so I'm thinking, how significant is the Auvergne region of France, the Massif Central, the very, very geographic center of France where people go to ski? I mean, this is a region that has such juice that they've got an embassy in Paris, where, you know, all the other regions like Brittany and Normandy, they'll have an office, but the Auvergne region actually has an embassy in Paris. That's how much juice these guys have. Because not only is produce, fresh fruits and vegetables, a big issue from the Auvergne region, A-U-V-E-R-G-N-E, Auvergne, but cheese is extraordinarily significant as regards the economy of the Auvergne, but on a grander scale, in the whole realm of cheese, I can't think of a more significant region in the world, in
really?
A cheese-producing country than the Auvergne region. Lynn, they produce, first of all, the Cantal, C-A-N-T-A-L, which is a big fire plug of a raw cow's milk cheese that's aged from 6 months to 2 years. It's similar to our cheddar and similar to the UK's cheddar, but not nearly as dense. Much more buttery, airy a cheese. And it's ubiquitous in France. It's like the third biggest selling cheese in France.
Huh.
So you see it all the time. And more evidence of how much juice the Auvergne has is that they, of the lousy 24 or 26 cheeses in France that have been designated name control, that is Appellation Control A, which means you're a very heavy hitter cheese if you're a name control
right,
cheese.
Right, right.
Cantal has three designations in there.
One area?
Appellation, yes.
Huh.
Three different forms of Cantal. Indeed, one of them is called Forme du Cantal. The other is Cantal de Salers. And then there's the great Laguiole, L-A-G-U-I-O-L-E. All three of these are Cantal cheeses with different names because they come from different village pastures areas.
Uh-huh.
I love it.
Now, what else comes from there?
Saint Nectaire. Beautiful name. And I spent so much time trying to find evidence of who this ancient obscure saint was named
Saint Nectar.
Nectar, Nectaire, C-T-A-I-R-E, and I finally gave up. And then I discovered, I wasn't even looking for it, but that Saint Nectaire was a corruption of an old family that lived in this area 800 years ago whose name was Saint Nectaire. They weren't saints. Their name was Saint Nectaire. It got corrupted into saint. But Saint Nectaire is one of the great semi-soft cow's milk cheeses from anywhere. You think of Chaume, and you think of Italian Fontina and Vacher and Fribourgeois and those kind of soft cheeses that you buy by the wedge. Well, Saint Nectaire is the definitive one. It's a cow's milk cheese with a natural reddish brown rind that is so interesting in that it houses five different specific molds that blow around in the air in this part of the Auvergne, and all five of those different molds and yeasts give a color to the rind, from green to white to red to blue and yellow. So it's a very beautiful cheese to see, and these rinds, if you rub them and smell them, they smell like lettuce. Very, very peculiar. But if you were to isolate the esters in these yeasts and molds and then compare them with the DNA of lettuce, I'll guarantee you they would have the exact same structure because that's the smell you get out of it. But the interior cheese is this glistening, bulging, very nutty, very vegetal, very grassy tasting cow's milk cheese that is a delight and just an absolute joy and underrated, enormously underrated.
Okay, I've got Cantal and I've got Saint Nectaire. For the saint of orange juice pressers. And what can you give me a third cheese from the Auvergne?
Oh, my Lord, you've got to immediately rocket to the fact that the great blues come from the Auvergne region, Forme d'Ambert and Blue d'Auvergne. There are several others, but they're very closely related to Forme d'Ambert and Blue d'Auvergne. Forme d'Ambert takes its name from Forme, which is where we get the word fromage and formaggio. It refers to the wooden molds that used to be whittled out by hand, that where the cheesemaker would glop in the curd in order to fashion the shape of the cheese. And Forme d'Ambert is this 5-pound cylinder. It looks like a Stilton that got miniaturized by Alice in Wonderland. It's just a 15-pound Stilton that shrunk down to a 5-pound cylinder. Exact same recipe. Gorgeous blue cheese, particularly when you cut it on the oblique and you get this gorgeous oval off of the thing. It looks sort of like the City Court building here in Manhattan. It's a beautiful thing to serve on a table. And it's a great buy. It's not one of those super expensive countryside cheeses. Forme d'Ambert is readily available all over the country, and people just may be afraid of it. It's the gentlest blue that I know. It's just so scrumptious.
I want to get on a plane and go to the Auvergne. Thank you.
Thank you.
C'est si bon de partir n'importe où, bras dessus, bras dessous, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon de se dire des mots doux, de petits rien du tout, mais qui ont dix ans long.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now you can find Steve behind the counter of the Fairway Markets in New York City. You can find Steve's cheese suggestions on our website at splendidtable.org. It's time for our weekly trivia question. The question is, what kind of plum did little Jack Horner pull out of his Christmas pie? Remember Jack? Jack was little Jack Horner, sat in the corner eating his Christmas pie. He stuck in his thumb, he pulled out a plum and said, oh, what a good boy am I. Well, again, the question is, what kind of plum did little Jack Horner pull out of his Christmas pie? We're going to be back in a moment with a cooking lesson for absolute beginners from the legendary Marion Cunningham, and we'll be taking your calls. The number is 1-800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Kasper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 1-800-537-5252. But before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to today's trivia question. Now, it's a gem for history buffs. The question was, in the nursery rhyme, which goes, Little Jack Horner sat in his corner, eating his Christmas pie. He stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum and said, oh, what a good boy am I. Well, what kind of plum did Jack pull out of the pie? The answer is it was a sugar plum. But this nursery rhyme from England in the 1500s was really like an investigative report. This was Plumgate, and the rhyme told all. Here's the story. Jack Horner was really Thomas Horner, who was the steward to the Abbot of Glastonbury. Now, this was around the time that King Henry VIII was taking over church properties all over England, and Glastonbury was one of the richest. The abbot, in trying to save the holdings of the abbey, sent Henry a Christmas pie. Baked inside the pie were the deeds to 12 manor houses and their lands. These were all part of the holdings of the abbey. It was an attempt to placate the king. The abbot had his faithful steward, Thomas Horner, carry the pie to London. Well, Thomas, the Jack of the nursery rhyme, took a little pause that refreshed. He reached in his thumb into the pie and pulled out a plum of a deed, the deed to Mell's Manor, a prize. His family still lives there today. They deny any wrongdoing, and Plumgate was never solved.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can't be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
Okay, it is that time. We are taking your calls this hour. The lines are open. Let's talk. The number is 1-800-537-5252. Anything you want to talk about, I'll give it a shot. Let's get to the phones. We've got Debbie on the line. Debbie, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. What's happening?
Well, I went out with this guy years ago, and he used to make this really great mayonnaise sauce that was warm to go on shellfish and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And all I remember is it had mayonnaise, butter, garlic, and Romano. And I've tried to do it again, and it's hard to cook mayonnaise. It's
sure
like impossible.
Sure is. Tends to break up into oil and floating egg, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. How did he do this?
Well, first of all, I want to know, I mean, the guy sounds like he was an imaginative cook. Why'd you get rid of him?
To
be personal.
He had a couple of us. He was cooking for more than one.
I understand.
Yeah.
I see. Nice euphemism.
Yeah.
Good take. I like this. Okay. Well, sometimes you accept certain things if they're good enough at it. At any rate, the deal here is that it would be a matter probably. Now, this sauce was thick and was
thick and really great.
Okay, I'm wondering if he did this. I wonder if he sautéed very slowly, cooked the garlic in the butter.
I think he did, something separately. The butter and then
right.
The mayonnaise went in after.
Yeah, because I think here's the deal.
Oh.
Here's what I would do.
Okay.
I would slice up garlic.
Uh-huh.
Did it have a lot of butter in it?
It seemed to have a fair amount.
Yeah, because I love this.
Like a cube.
Fat on, holy cow.
I think it was a cube, but I could be wrong. It's years ago.
Let's say that now we don't want to go completely to cholesterol heaven. Let's use half a cube.
Okay.
Three or four tablespoons to feed one. All right. How about two or three cloves of garlic, thinly slice them,
mm-hmm.
put them in a small saucepan,
mm-hmm.
heat up the cube of butter with that, or the half a cube, four tablespoons of butter,
mm-hmm.
and cook it real low.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to brown the garlic. You just want to stew it.
Okay.
Okay? And then I would take it off the heat,
mm-hmm.
let it sit for 10 minutes,
okay.
and then I would stir in the cheese, probably a fair amount of it. I'm thinking this was sort of spicy with the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd stir in, I'd have a little salt and pepper in there, but the cheese is going to be salty.
Okay.
I'd stir in the Romano, and then I'd stir in the mayonnaise to taste.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, you could play with this. I mean, one thing you could do is my temptation would be to add just a little bit of tomato or tomato paste to the garlic and the butter if you wanted to fool around with it.
Oh, yeah,
or your favorite herb, basil, could never hurt this mixture.
Oh, good, okay.
So this would be great.
The clue is don't cook the mayonnaise. Go warm the butter.
Warm the butter and then get the butter closer, not chilled, but, you know, don't let it be bubbling. Uh-huh. And then just stir in first the cheese and then the mayo. Let the cheese be the buffer.
Oh, well, thank you. I will try this tonight.
See what it tastes like.
Yes.
Okay, I wonder where the boyfriend is.
I don't know.
Maybe he's cooking in a restaurant.
I don't know.
You know, it'd be interesting. You know, you're going to be somewhere in the world and you'll taste this and you'll know he's in the kitchen.
Yes.
I love this.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Debbie.
Oh, bye-bye.
Evelyn's on the line. Evelyn, hi. What's up?
Well, basically, I need to know whether or not you actually boil water when you're trying to make the perfect pot of tea. As well, does it matter if the tea is herbal or black? And I have not been able to find the answer to this question for years.
I'm going to go back to what our tea expert, Bill Waddington, has told us.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains that when you're dealing with black teas,
mm-hmm.
you want water that is boiling. And freshly boiled, freshly drawn water
mm-hmm.
that is boiling, and the time it takes to leave the stove and you pour it over the tea is just the temperature it should be.
Okay.
But now he says with green teas, which are not fermented in any way,
right,
that there you want about 170 degrees.
Okay.
You know, boiling's 212.
Uh-huh.
170,
uh-huh.
which he says is steaming.
Okay.
And the brew is about 3 minutes. Now, by the way, the brew with black tea is about 4 to 6 with most of them.
Okay, right.
But what I'm wondering is when you are talking about herbal teas, maybe you are also talking about something that's similar to green teas. They're not fermented.
Mm-hmm.
They're dried.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find a real difference in taste when you do it with a high temperature liquid and a lower temperature one?
I do, actually. So I find that it's... Particularly with a rose hip sort of tea
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
peppermint, actually, I find that if I do boil the water, that it almost has like a sour taste to it.
This is a case where trust your mouth. You know, no, but seriously, I don't care what anybody tells us about the supposed to's.
Uh-huh.
Trust your mouth. If you like it better using a lower temperature water to brew, go for it.
Okay.
And I wouldn't be surprised because I think it does probably relate to this idea of green tea. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's not green tea, but these are pretty fragile.
Excellent.
Yeah, they're not fermented. They're just dried leaves.
Okay.
If you listen to the show regularly, Bill's on about once a month, and he's really specific.
Okay.
He's also obsessed with tea.
I know. Well, so am I. So.
But, you know, we need people like you. But thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Take care, Evelyn.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Brett's calling. Brett, what are you thinking about right now?
Hi, Lynn.
Not to be pushy.
No problem. Here's the story.
Okay.
My wife and I are biologists, and we were recently living at a remote field site in Madagascar where we were doing all of our own cooking over a charcoal fire with whatever.
This sounds fascinating.
Oh, it's fun. So we were bringing in our ingredients from the local market,
uh-huh.
and for a while we tried to eat like the Malagasy do, but in spite of having been colonized by the French, Malagasy cuisine is amazingly boring.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have thought with vanilla growing there and you know, I just have an exotic sense of it. I have no sense of what the food really is.
Well, they grow a tremendous number of spices there, but almost exclusively for export.
I'll be darned.
Oh, yeah. Most okay. Malagasy eat 3 big plates of rice a day, sometimes with broth, sometimes without. But
mm-hmm.
It's pretty much rice with rice.
Okay, so what were you actually eating then?
Well, we decided, we're both big fans of risotto at home, and so we started thinking about whether or not we could cook a risotto there, but having read cookbooks back in the States, mm-hmm. we knew there were all kinds of rules about the rice you use, because there probably isn't a bag of arboreal rice in all of Madagascar, and...
I think not. I mean, in terms of... Yeah, okay.
But we had little to lose, so we decided one night to try and cook it up using the regular white rice, and we were shocked to discover that, at least to our palates, it wasn't any worse than what we cook at home. So we're wondering, is arboreal rice some kind of a Northern Italian conspiracy, or what? Could we use brown rice?
Let me explain. Because in the days before, when I was a little kid, and my family's, you know, Italian, and risotto was very much a part of the way I was raised, and when I was a little kid and people couldn't get arborio rice very easily, people used long grain rice, but this rice called arborio, and there are other rices, there is a different kind of rice from the one you were using. What we're used to using in the United States is a long grain rice. Arborio and Canarole and other rices that are favored for risotto are medium grain rices. And evidently, the two have different starches. They actually have a different starch composition from one to the other. Long grain rice, when you cook it, has a tendency to be fluffy in individual grains. Medium grain rice, when you cook it, tends to have a kind of starch that produces a creamy quality, even if the rice still has a little bite to it. And a great risotto, they will say in Italy that a great risotto is like a wave. It flows almost. It's never soupy, but it has this wonderful creamy quality. So the reason why that medium grain rice is favored is that it produces that. The other thing is the medium grain rice is what's been grown through much of northern Italy. You know, it's sort of the dish evolved from what was there.
I see.
I don't think you have committed any kind of tremendous heresy making the risotto with long grain, which is, I think, what you must have used.
Yep.
But I don't think you've tasted primo
that
risotto.
That may be.
One other piece of information you should know, there are American-grown medium grain rices that if you can't get the Italian import, you can use them. So I'd say, you know, I'd say try it and see what you think. It's not really a ripoff. It is a different animal.
Different beast. What would happen, say, if I did try it with brown rice?
You're going to cook it a lot longer.
Yeah.
A lot longer, but you could still get some very nice results.
Hmm.
So try it. You just have to have a lot more patience, because instead of taking 20 minutes, it takes 30 or 40, sometimes even 50.
No problem.
No, do it. I mean, if you have the time, go ahead. Sure.
Well, thanks very much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Bye.
I envy you being in Madagascar.
Oh,
it's
great once you get past the bureaucrats.
Isn't a lot of life like that?
I guess that's true.
Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Hey, thanks to everybody for calling today. Remember, you can get us anytime. Put this number on your refrigerator, 1-800-537-5252. Marion Cunningham is a legendary cooking teacher and author of the newly published Learning to Cook with Marion Cunningham. She's joined us here in the studio. Hi, Marion. Good to have you here. Now, you have written a book called Learning to Cook with Marion Cunningham, and you're teaching absolute beginners to cook. Now, you've been teaching cooking for a long time. You like to work with beginners.
I love working with beginners. It's interesting. It's tremendously rewarding. It has made me much better at cooking and hopefully at writing recipes, because I had never realized how much we assume that people who don't know how to cook would never understand.
Well, you've been coming by to teach us some basics. So what do you want to talk about today?
I want to talk about baking powder biscuits.
Why
I know
biscuits? Why biscuits?
Because biscuits are so simple. It's really hard to flunk a biscuit if you do a few little steps, and that's the truth. Listen, these were put to the test with people ranked beginners that didn't know how to use a spoon mixing something in a bowl. And biscuits give everyone a sense of success. You know, if they serve a biscuit at a dinner table or a supper table, to me, along with, say, a mediocre soup, I feel I've really got it made. I mean, it's wonderful.
Oh, anybody who can make great biscuits, I feel I want to kiss the hem of their gown or whatever. But that's tricky stuff, isn't it?
Not really. When you think that the pioneer women coming across the country in covered wagons with one pot could be making baking powder biscuits, it's possible. We can all do it.
Okay, so how do we do biscuits?
What we do is first we turn the oven on to 450.
Okay.
And we have a bowl, and we put our flour into the bowl and a little bit of salt. And with our hand, we stir it around. And use hands. Use your hands, because your hands remember things. They remember how a dough feels. If you do this a few times, you could almost do it with your eyes closed. Anyway, you then take a big chunk of Crisco. I happen to like Crisco. You could mix it half butter, half Crisco, but let's call it Crisco.
Uh-huh.
You break that chunk, 1/3 of a cup of Crisco. I have 2 cups of flour in the bowl, half a teaspoon or a teaspoon of salt, and 1/3 of a cup of Crisco. And I break it into maybe five pieces, and I drop it over the top of the flour.
Wait a minute. I think you forgot something. The baking powder. How much baking powder?
Oh, yes, my dear, I did. That we need about 2.5 teaspoons of baking powder.
To 2 cups of flour.
To 2 cups
okay.
of flour.
All right.
So that is stirred along with the salt into the flour.
Right.
Then you drop the Crisco in and break it into chunks. And with your thumb and your index finger, you rub the flour. And I can tell you within 30 seconds to 1 minute, you will have the flour in irregular pieces, the size of crumbs, or a little larger.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like little tiny pebbles. And at that point, you want to add your liquid and stir that. And you don't do a lot to this. You don't want to overhandle it. So it isn't a question of working hard on this. It's very, as I say, a minute. And you put it on a floured board, and you take and pat it into, if you don't have a cookie cutter, you do it in a square, and then take a knife and cut it into, say, 1.5 inch squares. And place the biscuits on a greased sheet pan. And put them in the oven. You can't imagine the feeling of success.
What can you do to play with biscuits?
I like them with whipped cream and sliced strawberries. It's a wonderful shortcake solution. Or any kind of fruit. They can go on top of a stew. And it gives a little body to even a thin soup.
Huh.
These are the perfect things for beginners. The great Southern cook, Edna Lewis, can make a perfect biscuit. She has always described biscuits as being the jewelry that you might put on a simple black dress.
Marion, thank you.
You're welcome.
Marion Cunningham is author of Learning to Cook. Hey, everybody, thanks for calling today. Remember, you can get us anytime, day or night. The number is 800-537-5252. Thanks for being with us today, and do join us next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with a quote from an anonymous source, actually a bumper sticker. If you drink like a fish, swim, don't drive. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive collection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic white French line. Corningware can go from freezer to oven to the dinner table. To get a copy of the Stern's Roadside Food Finds and information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.